This series contains details of criminal activity and depictions of crime scenes. Listener discretion is advised. We are in Wales, in a small house in the rural county of Pembrokeshire. Inside, sat at the dining table, is a woman. She's hunched forwards, surrounded by garments, a sewing machine thundering back and forth as she delicately feeds the fabric through. Outside, rain batters against the window, though it's barely audible underneath the relentless whir of the machine. The woman picks up a pair of long grey shorts and starts to fold up the leg. She's adjusting them, making them shorter, so they'll become more like the kind you might wear to go swimming. She folds up the new hem and goes back to the sewing machine, fixing the new shorter length in place with a straight stitch. It's a scene you might find anywhere in the world. An unremarkable everyday activity. An exercise in recycling, restoring, reimagining one item of clothing to give it a new lease of life. But what this woman doesn't know is that the shorts she's adjusting are the smoking gun in a murder case, and her newly created hem will perfectly preserve the evidence, which will, eventually, lead to one of the most dangerous men in Welsh history being locked up for good. My name is Romola Gary, and I'm an actress who's always been fascinated by how criminal cases are solved, the amazing processes that go on behind the scenes, and the clues that clinch the case.
My name is Tracy Alexander. I'm the head of the British Academy of Forensic Sciences. I've spent years finessing these processes, searching for those clues. I've dedicated my career to using science to help the course of justice, and my work has ensured that hundreds of criminals have gone to prison and that the wrongly convicted have gone free.
Together, we're going to lift the lid on some of the most extraordinary cases from around the world.
We'll discover how, with the help of science, everyday items have become the key to catching a killer.
From What's the Story Sounds, this is Smoking Gun. Episode 2, The Bathing Shorts. Many stories in this series have a clear beginning, middle, and end. The story of a crime, an investigation, and a conviction. But this story, well, it has many beginnings and many crimes. But we'll start on one beautiful summer's day in Pembrokeshire, West Wales, with a couple who are walking on the famous Pembrokeshire coastal path. It's a winding, picturesque route, extending for 186 miles along cliff tops and through rolling countryside, all owned by the National Trust. Every year it attracts thousands of visitors, drawn by the scenery, the chance to escape the busyness of life and walk a section or two of this scenic pathway. In June 1989, Peter and Gwenda Dixon were two such visitors. They were on the last day of their holiday to Wales, where they'd been camping in a local caravan park. They loved the Pembrokeshire countryside and were regular visitors to the area. That day, they decided to go home and planned to set off around midday. They told a fellow camper that they needed some time to let their tent dry off, so they were setting out on a short walk on a section of the coastal path in the area close to the quaint village of Littlehaven. They packed a rucksack with a change of clothes and a few provisions, and set off around 9:30 a.m. Their walk would take them from Littlehaven along the path overlooking Rook's Bay, past the hamlet of Tolbeny, and onwards towards St Bride's, a meandering path that strays close to the cliff edge. Along their route, they expected to bump into fellow ramblers, cheerily greeting each other as they passed. The sun rose in the sky, and their legs ached in that satisfying way only a good walk can provide. It was the perfect day out to finish their holiday before heading back home to Oxfordshire. But 3 days later, on Sunday, July the 2nd, Peter and Gwenda Dixon's son contacted police to say his parents hadn't returned from their holiday. There were no mobile phones back then, and the son had no way of contacting his parents, other than to wait for them to arrive home. Police officers in Wales made some routine checks. It was so unusual for the couple to disappear, but everyone hoped there was a simple explanation. Police inquiries revealed the Dixons had been last seen heading off on their morning walk, but from there the trail went cold. Locals checked the caravan park and found the Dixons' tent and belongings exactly where they had been days earlier, but there was no sign of the Dixons. A search party was set up and appeals were issued on the local radio. Concern was building, but it would be 3 more days before the bodies of the Dixons were found by a walker in a small clearing adjacent to the coastal path, hidden from view and concealed under branches. They were just 600 yards from the campsite they'd set off from. The pair had been bound, robbed, and then shot at point-blank range. This coastal beauty spot in Pembrokeshire was now the scene of a horrific murder.
Detectives from the local David Powers Police were assigned to this case, a case unlike any most of them had ever come across. And initially, they had few clues to go on. There were no witnesses to the crime, and nobody came forward to say they had heard anything during their own walks or family days out. There was one report of gunshots ringing out at about 11 a.m, but in an area of farmland, hearing gunshot wasn't particularly unusual. The area of the attack was remote. Tolbeny Church was the only building within sight, perched up on a hill and looking down on the path below. Officers scoured the scene for any clues, evidence or fingerprints which pointed to who the attacker might be, but they found little. The couple's belongings had been ransacked, their rucksack emptied. It appeared a cash card was missing, but there was nothing which could immediately identify the killer. News of the attack spread quickly, through Pembrokeshire, then Wales, then across the UK. Police provided a visual presence to reassure other tourists and locals who feared there was a callous killer in their midst. A killer who wasn't afraid to use extreme violence to commit what appeared to be fairly low-value robbery. Some people refused to walk the path. Others found themselves looking over their shoulder at every turn. Meanwhile, the family of the Dixons were understandably devastated. Police needed to solve the case, and fast.
The first breakthrough came by tracing the bank cards stolen from the couple. In 1989, information could be gathered if stolen cards were used to withdraw money. In this case, detectives found that the stolen cards had been used several times after the murders of the Dixons, but before their bodies had been found. The first transaction was at 1:30 p.m. on the day of the murders, in Pembroke, a town about 30 minutes' drive away from Littlehaven. £10 was withdrawn using the card and PIN number. At 4 p.m, the card was used again to withdraw £100. And at 4:30, a man using the card bought a £40 pair of walking boots. Then, at 3 p.m. the next afternoon, a Friday, the card was used once more in Carmarthen, over an hour inland from the coastal path. And on Saturday, it was used at 7:15 a.m. in Haverford West, back in the vicinity of the crimes. CCTV hadn't captured an image of whoever was using the cards. While cameras were in use in some parts of the country, none had been in the right position in this small town to capture anything of use. The idea that security footage would ever have to be used for anything of this nature was previously unthinkable. But witnesses did provide a description of some of the Cashpoint users at the right times. Some said the man was dark-haired, and some placed him with fair hair. But one witness in Haverford West on the Saturday got a good look at the man, and an artist impression was made. It showed a distinct-looking man, wearing long grey shorts with shoulder-length brown curly hair. However, the witness had only seen the man from the back. They didn't see his face. So the description was little more than a hint as to who the killer might be.
Prompted by the wider appeals, more than 1,700 phone calls came into the police incident room. They included names, tips, sightings of someone with curly shoulder-length hair wearing long grey shorts. Each call and each potential lead had to be recorded by hand by the team of officers on the case, and they were stored on individual paper cards. But despite the vast interest in the case and the multiple leads coming into the incident room, none provided police with enough information to identify a suspect or make an arrest. It was a case seen through fog, and despite everyone's best endeavours, there was nothing to cut through it. The family of the Dixons held an emotional funeral, and the police vowed to catch the person or persons responsible. The case was featured on the BBC TV show Crime Watch 2 months after the attacks, with the Dixons' son even playing himself in the reconstruction, making that first call to the campsite to raise the alarm. Detectives told the show they were still looking to trace some of the walkers who'd been on the coastal path on the day of the crimes. But even a nationwide appeal on TV didn't provide the breakthrough they were hoping for. The trail ran cold, and life in Pembrokeshire tentatively moved on. Tourists returned to the area, and walkers were once again seen enjoying the coastal path.
In November of 1996, a local schoolteacher was settling down for the night with a glass of wine in hand. It was a Friday night, the end of a long week, and the fundraising show Children in Need was on TV. She was waiting for her husband to return home, when from nowhere, a masked man burst into the living room carrying a shotgun. The man was demanding money, forcing the teacher into her bedroom, hitting her in the face and tying her hands with rope. He threatened her, pointing the barrel of the gun into her neck. The teacher later told the police that she was convinced she would die. She described the man as wearing a green or camouflage jacket. He only fled after throwing a portable TV at his stricken victim, who managed to wriggle an arm free and press an intruder alarm. The attack on the teacher, in a small village close to the town of Milford Haven, was just the latest in a string of armed robberies which were terrorising this corner of Wales. In total, there were more than 30 crimes, all centred in or around the small harbour town of Milford Haven. The robber had been breaking into farmhouses and remote homes, often in the dead of night, and helping himself to cash, jewellery, and items of value. Police investigating those burglaries had tried numerous times to catch him, even staking out the roads and deploying sniffer dogs to try and track his scent. But the robber was always one step ahead. Detectives even found, on one weaving pursuit through fields and lanes, that the robber had scattered chili powder along his escape path to literally throw any pursuing sniffer dog off his scent. Attending the scene of one robbery, officers discovered the offender had left a double-barreled shotgun behind whilst running from the scene. It was taken into evidence immediately. After another burglary, investigators found a stash of stolen jewellery hidden in a hedgerow more than a mile from the scene. As the crime spree in this sleepy part of the world continued, seemingly at the hands of one person or one gang, a dedicated team was assigned the task of stopping the perpetrator. The crimes were all mapped, their locations analysed by officers who were looking for patterns or clues as to who was behind them and where they might strike next. On a crime wall, spiderwebbed by red string, a visual impression of the crimes came into view, and it seemed they all had something in common. They were all directly connected by a series of winding footpaths that crisscrossed rural Pembrokeshire, back to the home of a man known to the police, a man called John Cooper.
Cooper had been something of a local celebrity in the area. Back in 1978, he'd won £90,000 in a newspaper Spot the Ball competition, a very tidy sum that helped him fund a nice lifestyle, equivalent to £500,000 today. But over the years, that money had dwindled away. Depressed and frustrated by his circumstances, Cooper began to drink more and more heavily. Friends said the fortune had affected Cooper. There was a dark cloud over his head, which was getting stormier by the day, and the arguments between him and his wife began to escalate, sometimes into violent outbursts, frequently witnessed by his young son. Life in the Cooper household was unpleasant. His wife Pat had worked as a seamstress, but an accident with a horse had left her unable to earn a wage. Their son Adrian hated seeing the violence and left home as soon as he could. But despite the abusive relationship, Pat stood by her husband. But while John's turbulent home life hadn't attracted the attention of the police, he had come onto their radar for the robberies. In fact, with the crime scene pattern now established, he had become their prime suspect.
The crime scene pattern had been enough to secure a warrant to search John's home, and what police found was enough to convince them that their instincts had been correct. Throughout Cooper's home, in his bedroom, in the kitchen, the lounge, even the garden, were numerous items which linked him to the crime spree of robberies over the recent years. One officer found a shotgun in a hedgerow, and they found jewellery and ornaments which had been stolen. These finds directly linked Cooper to specific crimes. Perhaps most tellingly, inside the house, they found more than 500 keys, evidence perhaps of the scale of Cooper's criminal career. The combination of all the evidence was enough to charge Cooper as a serial armed burglar. He was accused of the attack on the schoolteacher and 30 more crimes. Cooper denied the allegations, but in court in December 1998, a jury found him guilty, and John William Cooper was jailed for 16 years. But there was no link to the murders of the Dixons, or anything else.
There's one other crime which is an important part of this story. A crime which predates all of these. Back in December of 1985, a fire engulfed a mansion home called Scoverston Park, just a few miles from Milford Haven. The flames could be seen for miles, the property itself almost completely destroyed. But inside, investigators found the bodies of the two occupants, Richard and Helen Thomas. What appeared to be a tragic accident took a more sinister turn when a post-mortem investigation found that both victims had died from gunshot wounds. Helen had been bound and gagged before being shot in the head, while Richard had initially been shot in one of the outhouses before being dragged into the house and shot once more. That crime had remained on file for years, an open, if not particularly active, investigation. There were no leads and no suspects, and little in the way of evidence to examine. Now, in the early years of the new millennium, Pembrokeshire and the town of Milford Haven was in relative calm. There hadn't been any more tragic incidents. The robberies had stopped. There was little doubt that Cooper had been responsible for terrorising the area with that string of attacks. But was he also a killer? Had he been responsible for the double murder at Scoverstone Park? And was he behind the double murder of Peter and Gwenda Dixon on the coastal path? There was some suggestion that he could be. After all, both murders had featured a double-barreled shotgun, the same type of weapon used in the robberies that Cooper was already convicted of. And all the crimes had taken place in the same geographical area. This didn't amount to any kind of proof. For that, Dyfed Powys Police would need some forensic evidence, some scientific link to connect Cooper to the crimes. And so, in 2006, they launched a brand new inquiry called Operation Ottawa to review the unsolved murders and see if there was any evidence that could solve them. I've led many cold case inquiries where investigations are reopened years after the event to see if new techniques or a fresh pair of eyes can shed light on what happened. With every one, it's important not to go looking for clues which can implicate a particular individual, but to go looking with an open mind. And that's what the police did with Operation Ottawa. But at the back of their minds, they knew that Cooper could be a prime suspect.
To reinvestigate the murders, police called in a leading forensic scientist, one of the pioneers of modern forensic review, Dr. Angela Gallup. She had become a household name in UK policing after being a part of the team who uncovered evidence in the case of the murder of Stephen Lawrence, Damilola Taylor, and a case known as the Cardiff Three. Her specialist skills involved using ever smaller pieces of DNA and being able to extract it from all sorts of items. Detectives hoped she could do the same thing with their cases in Wales, and she was tasked with reviewing the existing evidence. The first job was to find out what items had been kept from the crime scenes, where they had been stored, and if they had been kept properly. In every major investigation, one police officer is assigned the role of exhibits officer. They have the task of labelling everything which is gathered and ensuring it can be easily retrieved. In the case of the Coastal Path murders and the Scoverstone Park fire, there had been two separate investigations and two exhibits officers with over 1,000 individual items. Each one had a number and was assigned a location to be stored. There was a system in place to make sure that the pieces of evidence couldn't come into contact with each other, making sure that no forensic clues could be transferred to another piece of evidence. If a case ever comes to trial, this system is essential to prove that the forensic evidence is genuine and not the result of contamination. So, the process was slow. The exhibits officer would methodically retrieve items, check that they contained what they were supposed to contain, and then select the most interesting for Dr. Gallup to retest. Her focus began with DNA. It is perhaps the item we first think of when we imagine a forensic assessment of a crime. Back in 85 and 89, when the murders had taken place, DNA technology was in its infancy. Officers were barely aware of the unique information stored in our DNA, let alone equipped to perfectly preserve DNA for testing in the future. But now, in the 2000s, scientific techniques had advanced. DNA could be retrieved from much smaller sources. Instead of just finding it in blood or saliva, experts like Dr. Gallup could now obtain DNA profiles from items which the killer may have handled or come into contact with. The search began, starting with the rope that had been used to tie Peter Dixon's hands behind his back. Then his belt, items of Gwenda's clothing that had been pulled down or pushed up, anything which was likely handled by the killer. Hopes were raised. Surely there would be a trace. But nothing definitive was recovered.
Next, Dr. Gallup and her team looked at swabs taken from the bodies of the victims. They'd been collected as a matter of routine by officers in the 1980s, but once again, despite the fact that they'd been stored properly, they didn't hold any crucial evidence. So Dr. Gallup moved away from DNA analysis. She knew that other clues could lay hidden within the items collected from the scenes, and they included the branches which had been used to conceal the bodies of Peter and Gwenda Dixon. On those branches, the scientists found lots of blue acrylic fibres, the kinds of fibres you might find in a pair of gloves. Nowadays, you might be familiar with fibre analysis. Before the advent of DNA, it was one of the jewels in the crown for forensic scientists. Under a microscope, individual threads can be assessed. They're often tiny, sometimes not visible to the naked eye, but these fibres can be transferred when one item comes into contact with another. Experts can tell what the fibres are made from, where they were manufactured, and even what dye has been used to colour them. When fibre analysis was at its height, a database of dye colours existed to allow scientists to make an exact match and help trace the origin of a fibre. But in this case, Dr. Gallup predicted that the fibres had come from gloves. The team half expected the killer would have worn gloves. Many criminals in the 1980s knew that fingerprints could be incriminating. But the gloves, well, perhaps they'd be just as valuable to investigators. The same blue fibres were found on Peter Dixon's belt too. The fibres surely belonging to the killer. But would they find them anywhere else? Next, Dr. Gallup looked at items taken from the home of John Cooper and from the hedgerows around where he lived. Could they find a link here to the unsolved crimes? Well, amongst the items recovered was a glove, a blue glove. And under analysis, Dr. Gallup was able to show that the glove was made of the same fibres that had been found on the branches which covered the Dixons. Whoever was wearing that blue glove had likely killed the Dixons. But while the glove was assumed to belong to John Cooper, he would deny it was his. And as it had been found outside his property, in the hedgerows nearby, he could argue that someone else had left it there. So, while it strengthened the police's belief that he was responsible, it wouldn't be enough to charge him. Police needed more. Next on Dr. Gallup's list of items was the shotgun found in the same hedgerows, the one police believed had been used in the robberies that Cooper was convicted of. What clues did that gun conceal? Analysis under a microscope revealed it had been painted black, and on the barrel, some of the paint was starting to flake away. So the scientists went one step further to pull the paint away, and underneath, preserved by the paintwork, was a spot of blood. Blood which Dr. Gallup could now show belonged to Peter Dixon.
This was an extraordinary find. Detectives hypothesised that the gun had been used in the murder of the Dixons and then been painted by John Cooper. Unwittingly, he'd preserved the evidence underneath the layer of paint. But once again, there was an issue. Cooper would deny the gun was his, just like he would deny the gloves were his. The case against him was getting stronger, but they needed a smoking gun that Cooper couldn't wriggle away from. So the investigators turned to items seized from inside Cooper's home. One of these items was a pair of swimming shorts, found in Cooper's kitchen when he was arrested. They were a khaki grey colour, and under a microscope, they presented a treasure trove of evidence. At the bottom, above the hem, was a tiny spot of blood which matched Peter Dixon. In fact, it was a one in a billion match. This linked Cooper to the murders of Peter and Gwenda Dixon. But there was more. In the pocket, scientists found fibres which matched a sock recovered from the fire at Scoverston Park. It was an undeniable match, and the experts pondered how it had got there. What they discovered was that whoever had killed Richard and Helen Thomas in Scoverston Park had touched that sock, and fibres from the sock had been picked up on their gloves. Then, years later, the same gloves had gone into the pocket of the shorts and left the fibre in the pocket. So police now had evidence linking the shorts to both double murders and John Cooper. But there was one final twist in the forensic case.
Detectives now had enough to question John Cooper and ask for his version of the events. They summoned him from prison and began to ask him about the various pieces of evidence. Now, remember, in the days after the Dixons were murdered on the coastal path, a witness had seen a man using their bank card on the streets of Milford Haven. And that witness had helped to create an artist's impression of what the man looked like. Stocky, with shoulder-length curly hair and wearing khaki shorts. Detectives first wanted to see if the artist's impression resembled what Cooper had looked like at the time, and they were in luck. Just weeks after the murders, John Cooper himself had appeared on a TV game show called Bullseye. He'd been competing to win a cash prize, and in the show, he talked about his love of the Welsh countryside. That footage was obtained by officers who were amazed to find that Cooper's hair and build exactly matched the artist's impression. As the lead detective explained, it was so similar, it looked like a tracing. But also in the artist's impression, the man was wearing shorts, and police officers suspected that they were the same ones seized from Cooper's home. So they asked him. Cooper agreed that the shorts shown to him were his. He described them as his bathers, swimming shorts. Officers then showed him the artist's impression and asked John Cooper if he agreed that the image showed the same shorts. But Cooper had an intriguing observation. He looked closely at the shorts and pointed out a subtle difference. His shorts were bathers. They were short shorts. The shorts in the drawing, they were long shorts. They couldn't be the same. Detectives were surprised, but admitted the length of the shorts differed. But it drew their attention to the hem. Back under the microscope, Dr. Gallup took another look, and sure enough, she found that the shorts had been altered. They were once long shorts, which had been turned up and transformed into short shorts. And underneath that newly sewn hem, on the longer part of the shorts, was another spot of blood. This blood didn't match the Dixons, and it didn't match the Thomases, and it didn't match John Cooper. Instead, it matched the Dixons' own daughter.
Confused? Well, so were the detectives, until they made a startling realization. John Cooper had murdered the Dixons wearing his own clothes. But in carrying out the crime, he'd got covered in blood. So he ransacked the Dixons' belongings and found a change of clothes, some shorts belonging to Gwenda Dixon. Those shorts had a spot of blood on them from the Dixons' daughter, something as innocuous as a cut finger or a grazed knee. Cooper had then put on the shorts and made his way into town where he'd withdrawn the money on the Dixons' bank card. He'd then kept the shorts and asked his wife to shorten them and turn them into bathers. Perhaps they were a trophy, a reminder of the bloodshed on that summer's day of 1989. But while they may have provoked memories for John Cooper, they'd also contained the evidence that linked him to two double murders. There was no more room for excuses or denials. The weight of evidence from the artist's impression to the shorts, the gloves, and the shotgun made an overwhelming case. By now, John Cooper was out of prison, back on the streets as a free man. So police were sent to arrest him and charge him with 4 counts of murder. On May of 2009, Cooper was apprehended on the streets of Haverford West. When those arresting officers looked into his car, they found a map, a balaclava, and some rope. He was apparently plotting another crime spree. In 2011, Cooper stood trial. A jury heard the evidence and his denial, and they believed that he was guilty of all 4 murders. John William Cooper was found guilty and told he would spend the rest of his life in prison. Smoking Gun is a What's the Story original podcast series. It's narrated by me, Romola Gary.
And me, Tracy Alexander.
And supported by the British Academy of Forensic Science. Their work supports the international fight to improve forensic techniques, to share ideas, and develop the crime-solving scientific advances of the future. If you've enjoyed this episode, please give it a rating and review, and help spread the word. You can listen to a new episode of Smoking Gun every week, wherever you get your podcasts.